This is Michael Dorn of Star Trek The Next Generation, and your hailing frequencies are open to 90.1 FM WUSB Stony Brook, where every Friday night at 11:30, Destinies, the voice of science fiction, goes where no radio show has gone before.
Theorizing that one could time travel within his own lifetime, Dr. Sam Beckett led an elite group of scientists into the desert to develop a top-secret project known as Quantum Leap. Pressured to prove his theories or lose funding, Dr. Beckett prematurely stepped into the project accelerator and vanished. He awoke to find himself in the past, suffering from partial amnesia and facing a mirror image that was not his own. Fortunately, contact with his own time was maintained through brainwave transmissions with Al, the project observer, who appeared in the form of a hologram that only Dr. Beckett can see and hear. Trapped in the past, Dr. Beckett finds himself leaping from life to life, putting things right that once went wrong and hoping each time that his next leap will be the leap home.
Good evening and welcome to Destinies. I'm Howard Margolin, and tonight the voice of science fiction is coming to you live as we speak with Christopher DePalippis, author of the new Quantum Leap novel, Foreknowledge. Welcome to Destinies, Chris.
Hello, Howard. Hello, everybody.
And this is your first novel, so how about telling us what was involved in getting this book published?
Well, it was a long road. It took me over 3 years. What happened was when I was back in college, I had written a script based on Quantum Leap, and I had no place to go with it. I didn't know what to do with it. But one day I was in a bookstore, and right there on the shelf was a book called Quantum Leap, the novel. And I said to myself, well, finally, maybe we can do something with this story. And I contacted Berkeley Publishing. They're the ones that do the book. And I got to know the editor a little bit, having met her at one of the Quantum Leap conventions.
That's Ginger Buchanan.
Yes,
right?
Ginger Buchanan. I got to know her a little bit. She seemed enthused in my work, and I sent her the story from that script. Well, it turned out they didn't like that one too much because she said it wasn't commercial enough, too much like fan fiction. But I kept contact with them. I kept plugging away. And a few years later, we finally arrived at a plot that we both liked. And from there, here we have Foreknowledge.
Did you have any foreknowledge that this book would be published?
Lots of hope. Not so much knowledge, but we went back and forth a lot on the ending, on the plot, on things that seemed very big at the time. But now I can see how the collaborative process works with an editor, and I think it made it a better book overall. So I was glad that I was able to come up with something that we were both happy with.
Well, you said it took 3 years to get this through revisions and then through everything else, another 6 months to write it.
Mm-hmm.
When would you turn this finished manuscript into Ginger Buchanan?
Well, let's put it this way. When we finally got the plot down to a point where we both liked it, she called me. She said, I think it's a go. That was September of 1996. From that point, I had about 50 pages written and a detailed plot outline. And I started writing every night, moonlighting. And by the time I was finished, it was just after Christmas. It had to be December 28th or 29th.
So this has been sitting, basically, in her office waiting for publication for well over a year.
Well, I wouldn't say sitting. It becomes a process because once you turn in a manuscript, there are certain things that are done within the publishing community. First is, I guess, coordinating it in-house, assigning it to editors to look it over. And I think Ginger does these by herself. Once that is done, you get back your manuscript with all the red lines on it. It's a really good thing to see, I have to tell you. You look through, and being an editor myself, I saw all the red lines. I said, maybe I'm not as good a writer and editor as I thought. But once that's done, you make changes where you think are necessary. You correct their changes if you think it's necessary. You send that back. Then you get what are called galley proofs. And that is the book typeset, the way it'll look on the page. and then you have to go through and proofread that as well. And again, this process must have taken from the time I gave them the original manuscript to getting the galley proofs. I don't think I got them until about September.
Of 97?
Yes. And then from there, it was a pretty quick process. We got the cover art, and then the cover flats came in, which is the cover art with all the type and my name imposed on it. And it went from there.
You mentioned you were an editor. That's what you do professionally?
Yeah, I'm a journalist and editor.
Who do you work for?
I work for a place called the Catholic Press Association. It's based in Ronkonkoma. And it is an association that represents Catholic newspapers, magazines, Catholic print media around the country. And I do a trade publication there, a yearly directory.
So Quantum Leap is a real quantum leap from that, I guess.
Well, Quantum Leap is the basic. The Catholic press is really the leap for me, considering the fact that I'm not Catholic.
That is a big leap, yeah.
Yes. Well, I just hope that nobody's listening to this. I think they don't know. I just might have seriously damaged my credibility now. But I've been working there for a number of years, so I'm not really very worried.
Actually, when they look at you, they see a Catholic man.
I think they do. With a name like DeFilippis, they say I look Irish. So my boss says, "Don't worry about it. They won't even ask." But that has been the quantum leap. Writing for the book series has been what I always wanted to do, and it's sort of been the goal that I've had, the focus that I've had, and my jobs have been the aside.
So you plan, I assume, one day of making writing fiction a full-time career?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And it's going to be a long process, I realize that. But, I mean, considering it took me 3 years just to get my first book, hopefully it'll start rolling now, maybe there'll be some momentum. But it's just hit or miss. It's something that you have to keep plugging at, keep plugging at, and keep plugging at. And that's why, I mean, say, authors, even when you do get published, it's not like you can quit your job.
Right. You have to have lots of book contracts before you can make that a permanent job. Yeah. Now, I assume you were a big fan of Quantum Leap when it was on the air.
Oh, yeah. It was my favorite show. And that's what sparked the interest in the book series, was because it was just something that entertained me so much and had such character and such story, such good plots. It was just a really excellent show. And finding a way to contribute to it was my inspiration. And going through, let's see, I did my first scene during a screenwriting class in college. It was the first bit of Quantum Leap that I set down on paper.
When you wrote this script, did you have any intention of submitting it at the time to Don Belisario?
Oh, yeah. I really was a fool. If I didn't know anything about writing, I didn't know anything about submitting scripts, and what I did was I had the script, you know, and said a little prayer over it. I put it in a FedEx envelope, and I found an address for Universal Studios, and all I wrote on the top of Universal Studios, attention Quantum Leap scripts, and you know, I didn't know about agents, I didn't know anything about it, and you know, much to my dismay, it came back a couple of weeks later, returned to sender, unopened, and I'm thinking, oh great, maybe I should learn a little bit more about this business if I ever hope to be successful in it.
Do you still hope one day to be a screenwriter, or would you prefer to set your sights on novels?
Well, I like the novels because just from what I've heard and what I've learned, you can really do more of what's inside of you. You can set that down and it'll be truer in novel form. Once you're in screenwriting, it becomes such a collaborative process and everybody is out to rewrite it 7 different ways based on what the director thinks, based on what the producer wants, based on whoever. And it turns out oftentimes that the script that you had in mind and what's actually produced are nowhere near each other.
I've heard, reading enough about how Star Trek episodes were rewritten time and time again, even Harlan Ellison's scripts,
yes,
that it must be very disheartening for someone who writes for a TV show, especially a new writer.
Well, I think it is disheartening if you take this purist attitude toward it. If you are going to go at it as a professional and want to really get into the business, it's something you just have to take for granted. You have to take it with a grain of salt, and you can't be so creatively controlling that you're not willing to bend. And, you know, if you learn, I guess, like anything, if you learn to play the game, you'll be successful and you'll eventually get to do what you want.
Now, in making the revisions to your novel, did most of what you wrote make it in, or did they have to do extensive rewriting?
Well, it wasn't so much extensive rewriting. Everybody liked the premise, and what it came down to was the resolution. And I had much more grandiose ideas than what we eventually wound up with. The upside of the collaboration, I think what we wound up with and what we collaborated on is much better. It's a much stronger ending, in the sense that it's not way out there. It's something that everybody can grasp. And at the same time, I was able to keep in the things that I wanted. It was doing the work that I wanted, but shaping it in a different way. And that's what I found the challenge.
Now, the goal of the book series is obviously to keep the franchise out in the public eye, especially since now it's been in reruns on the Sci-Fi Channel for the last few years.
Yes.
But how do the books approach the concept of the series? Is a novel supposed to be the equivalent of a TV episode, or is it supposed to be a TV episode with an unlimited budget and unlimited time?
It's a TV episode only limited by imagination, because you can write about anything, and they can take place over, I guess, however much time you need to tell your story. But they do have to maintain the parameters of the TV show. So basically, one book, one leap. And in order to get a story that I think that they're going to want, you can't go too over the top. I mean, you do have to keep it to what the fans come to expect from the TV show, because that's what drew them in the first place.
Now, are there any restrictions on types of stories that you're not able to tell when you're writing a Quantum Leap novel?
Well, it depends on, I guess, the touchiness of the subject matter. I do know that one of the authors who wrote a couple of books for the series had her third book turned down because it dealt with the AIDS virus. And that was something that Universal wanted to stay away from. I don't know why, but it was just something they didn't feel comfortable publishing. As well, it can't be too much like fan fiction. You have to keep it more of a commercial commodity. If it's too much into the show, gets too much into the show's minutiae, other fans might like it, other fans might appreciate it, but it would go over the head of the average reader. So they're walking on a tightrope, in a sense, because they do want to please the fans that are out there, but they don't want to drive away people that might be new to it, that might have just seen a couple of reruns and said, oh, that's a good show. Well, wait a minute, look at this book, and then pick up the book and say, well, I don't know what they're talking about.
So. Well, I've never really been a big fan of Quantum Leap. I did watch the pilot. I wasn't all that impressed by it. I watched maybe one or two other episodes over the course, and I did watch the ending, which I found thoroughly confusing. But I was able to follow your book, for the most part. There are some of the background characters that are at Project Quantum Leap that I wasn't familiar with, and you do tie in an episode somewhere in your book.
Yes.
You said first season?
Yes.
Which, obviously, I wouldn't have realized that's a tie-in, but I had a feeling from reading it that it was a tie-in.
Well, that was the intended goal, in the sense that if you're not that big of a fan, but you do know the premise of the show, you can read this book and enjoy it, but at the same time, if you are a fan, there's a different level that you'll enjoy it on as well, because you'll get the nuances, you'll get the subtleties. There's even some inside jokes from some of the East Leap conventions that I've attended. That one person bought the book at auction at the last East Leap, and she emailed me and she said, "Oh yeah, I got that," you know. So it's just you try to tie in what you can, but keep it readable for the general fan.
Right. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but on the show, didn't each episode continue into the next one? Whereas if he would leap into whoever he would leap into at the end of episode 3 would be the person he would begin episode 4 as, and et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, that was the hook. That was the way they kept you going. It was sort of, I think, lifted from Lost in Space. Because each week they would solve the problem 5 minutes before the show ended, and then all of a sudden, I don't know, Dr. Smith would fall down a well, and they'd say, tune in next week. It was sort of the same premise. Sam would leap out, the blue light would fade, and then he'd be in this totally unpredicted situation, and there you had the old boy, and that's where everything ended. And you say, oh boy, you know, I got to tune in next week.
Okay. So if that was the case, if all the episodes connected to each other, where do the Quantum Leap novels fit in? I mean, with Star Trek books, it's easy. You know, an episode ended, and then the next one picked up at an indeterminate time, so you could always squeeze something in, but there's no, doesn't seem to be any place to squeeze in a book.
I'm going to go with the tried and true quote from Don Bellisario, who created the show. It's just a show, folks. Try not to look at it too closely. Yes, I do realize that the episodes did go one into the other, but hey, it's off the air. This is something the fans can still look at. Do we really care? It's just...
Well, I don't know. I think hardcore fans would probably go, well, are these books considered canonical by Don Bellisario? Or are
no.
they considered basically Quantum Leap fiction, as it were?
Quantum Leap fiction, much like the Star Trek series, much like any tie-in series.
With the exception of the Babylon 5 books, from what I understand.
In the novel form. See, yeah. I don't know that. And I think the Star Wars books really stick to this internal consistency as well.
And I think they're considered by Lucasfilm to be official, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I think most, if not all of the... Some of the Babylon 5 books are considered to be canonical in
mm-hmm.
the Babylon 5 chronology.
No.
But I know the Star Trek books are not, and I guess the Quantum
no.
League ones aren't either.
No, because I think it's kind of silly to have a book series that's canonical, because if it does take off and the series proliferates, you will either have to have a select group of three or four authors looking back at every book. I would say, look at the Star Trek series. They have more than 84 or 85 books just for the original series alone. If you tried to make those canonical, where would you be? It would be so interrelated, so entwined, that it would be impossible to continue. And I think that having them not be official for the show, but based on the show, is a better way to go. Personally, that's a better choice.
Do the books have to maintain an internal consistency with each other through Ginger?
Not at all. Let's put it this way. This is a big debate in fandom. Does Sam's mind leap or does Sam's body leap? And the first few books in the series went with the mind leap theory. And people, they were seeing red, because there are some episodes in which it's perfectly clear that it's Sam's body that's there. One that comes to mind is when he leaped into a vet with no legs, and toward the end of the show he stood up, even though the person that he leaped into didn't have the legs.
How was that visualized by the people who were in that time period?
Well, only one person saw him, and Sam quickly knocked him out, but it was as if a man with no legs was walking across the room with ending at the knee, but still standing, with about, I don't know, a foot or two above the floor.
So he's like hovering.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that, is, to me, is pretty conclusive evidence of body leaping. But then there are other episodes in which, for example, he leaped into a pregnant woman. And at the end, he was giving birth. I mean, if his body is there, how can he be giving birth?
Right.
See, and that... So I saw it as not something that was hard and fast on the show.
Well, even in your book, there's a scene where back at Quantum Leap, Project Quantum Leap, you have the character he's leaped into, Candy Apple. We'll get into the plot of your book in a minute, because we should discuss the plot of the book. He leaps into a female mud wrestler in 1988, and at Project Quantum Leap, they are consoling their visitor.
Yes.
But she's in Sam's body, or at least as you write it, the others at Project Quantum Leap see Sam's body there.
Right. Well, the way it works on the show is when Sam leaps, the people around him see him as the person that he has replaced, and they have written it off as that person's physical aura surrounding him. Now, it would be the reverse back in 1999 at the project. The people there, even though it's not Sam, would see Sam, but clearly someone else is inhabiting that space. And when they look in the mirror, they see Sam, just like Sam sees the person he's leapt into when he's looked in the mirror.
Now, when you approach writing a Quantum Leap novel, are you given, for example, a copy of the series Bible to reference, or do you just go by your own memories?
You go by your own memories. There is a book out there called Quantum Leap A to Z by Julie Barrett, and it is a dictionary of Quantum Leap, so to speak. There is no show Bible. When I was attempting to write that first script, I called up the production department and I requested one, something that I, at that time, knew you should do, and they said, we don't have one. You know, just make it 63 pages and that's that. So, I mean, again, I don't think they were very big on continuity. They were just out to entertain. And once the show took on a life of its own, it was the fans that said, wait a minute, well, you contradicted your first season here, or, you know, this is not how it was. And some of the books actually deal with a couple of those contradictions in creative ways.
I think that's what you can do in a book. You can look at it from an analytical point of view and take your 280 pages and do something with it, as opposed to a 63-page script, which runs 48 minutes on television.
Right.
Now, let's talk about the plot of the book. Where did you get this idea? According to your dedication, you dedicated to Uncle Carl, who asked what happens when they come back.
Yeah, well, that was something that always struck me in the show. My uncle just put it in the most simple way I could think of. Actually, he's my uncle-in-law. But he said to me, I've been watching it, and, you know, it's great that he does all these nice things for these people, but what happens when he leaves and they come back? You know, all of a sudden they have these changes in their lives. And how do they know how these changes came about? How do they, much like when Sam leaps in, he's off balance. They come back to their lives, it's completely changed, whether big or small. And I always thought that that should be explored a little more. And coming at it with more interest, I thought, well, what if somebody had their life changed by Sam but didn't like that change? What would happen? And that was where the germ of the book was, and we went on from there. And that was actually different than my first idea, that first script. That was the second story I had to pitch them in order to actually make a sale to the series.
Well, you said there's a section of the book that sort of crystallizes the entire plot and summarizes it for the readers. Let's hear that excerpt from the book now.
Okay, well, the character's name who doesn't like the changes in her life, and I don't want to divulge too much of the plot, but basically she's wound up in prison and she doesn't know how. And she has nightmares, and this is a scene in which she's having a nightmare, obviously of her leap experience, although she doesn't know that. A blinding light tore through her and hurtled her soul into a blue void that expanded forever. She flailed through it at an impossible speed, yet could feel no sense of movement, no taste, no smell. Horror ripped through her, a dread that had no equal. She was lost, cast adrift, alone. A sudden force pulled her, drawing her atom by atom into the center of a swirling vortex that raged eternally. The nebula coalesced around her, gaining substance. Feeling was returning. She could faintly sense a heart beating, blood circulating. Cool air brushed against her skin. Sound met her ears, and she turned her head toward it. Vague shadows united and became two people wearing white coats, standing within arm's reach and speaking softly. The feeling of horror that had engulfed her before increased tenfold, and she let out a scream. Amory sat up with a start, gasping in the darkness that surrounded her. Clutched by fear, she reached over and switched on the small lamp on the nightstand next to her bunk. The light threw odd shadows in the familiar confines of her cell, low rates that she found more disquieting than the dark. In 3 years, she had moved to better quarters, behaved herself, gotten privileges, but she was still in prison. She went to the sink, splashed cold water on her face, and rubbed it through her sweaty hair. The nightmare images faded quickly, leaving only a vague feeling of unease. She looked into the mirror and forced herself to take a few deep breaths, willing her features to calmness. Nightmares had been a fairly regular occurrence ever since she got to prison, but she was sure these dreams were about more than having her freedom stripped away. They went deeper somehow, and were coming more often. She could never remember them afterward. The only calling card they left were cold sweat and confusion. She was sure they had something to do with the lapse of memory she suffered, but she couldn't figure out how or why. Anne-Marie stripped off her drenched T-shirt and pulled on a fresh one. She sat on a bunk, fingering the law book stacked neatly on the night table, books that she hoped would show her some loophole to freedom. But they offered little solace now. The perpetual wondering took its toll and demanded attention now and again, no matter what mental discipline she tried to maintain. How, she thought. The thought came upon her so quickly and furiously that she swept the meticulously folded figures onto the floor and was halfway across the cell before she realized it. How did she wind up here? The answerless question weighed her soul down into the now familiar terrain of blind wonder. I can't stand by and let it strip me of my sanity. Someone did this to me. I'll figure out how and who, and they'll pay for it.
An excerpt from Quantum Leap, Foreknowledge by Christopher DeFilippis, who is here live in the studio with us at this very moment. And that's the main plot right there. I mean, that really does sum it up.
That does kind of crystallize it.
Now, while this is the last person Sam leaped into, Sam himself
is on a current leap. It's, I thought of it as more comic relief because the plot of this is so heavy. I mean, you have this woman who is increasingly frustrated and mad and trying to figure out just what the heck happened to her life. And It builds from there, and I thought, what better way to relieve that tension, you know, every other chapter than have Sam in his most embarrassing leap? Everybody who watched the show knew he was sort of a prude, And when he leaps in, he's in a mud wrestling rink. You know, bikini all ripped apart, a girl jumping on top of him, and he's just incredibly embarrassed. And I thought it would be a good leap in, and it went from there. I mean, eventually, the book does come together, and you will see resolution. But that's all I really want to say for now.
It does work, though, because I'll tell you, I wrote about the mud wrestler in the promo for this week's show, and one of the DJs was reading it, and he lost it completely. He goes, Sam Beckett's latest leap in which he becomes a female mud wrestler in 1988. He totally lost it. Couldn't get through.
Well, see, I did my job.
Yeah, so obviously that does work as a tension breaker. One thing you mentioned is, and I always found this kind of odd, the series allegedly begins in 1999, and no. Sam was supposedly born in 53 or 54.
Right.
Scott Bakula never looked like he was 46 years old on that show.
Can I tell you something? Actually, the character of Sam was supposed to be around 43, which I think is Scott Bakula's age.
Back in 1988 or currently?
I think back in 1988.
Really?
Tell you the truth, I don't know how old Scott Bakula is. He doesn't look that old to me.
Right.
And at the same time, again, the show was on for 5 years, but they always said it was 1999. Hmm. So again, don't look at this too closely, folks. It's just a show. So, I mean, you're talking about continuity. Well, I think the books can be permissible if it's 1999 for 5 years straight back at the project, you know.
Yeah, well, I remember when in the final episode when Sam looked at himself in the mirror for the first time in 5 years, he said, I've got a gray hair.
Right, I've got crow's feet.
Yeah,
and
so he was surprised. So somewhere I don't think he would have been 46 when he started leaping. You know, which would have made, if he was born in 53 and he leaped in 1999, I mean, most people by 46 have a little gray or some crow's feet at this point.
Mm. Or you can also take into account what they called on the show the Swiss cheese factor, in which Sam, as the leaper, has holes in his memory. He can't really remember his life before he started leaping, or little snippets come to him here and there. And perhaps he looked in the mirror and didn't remember that he had gray hair, or because he said, I got gray hair, I got crow's feet.
Yeah.
And now he's always had that white lock.
Did he? I didn't remember that from the beginning.
Yeah. I don't know what it's from, but I don't know if it's old age or just genetics or what. But maybe the producers put it there.
Now, the books can't take place after the last episode? Is there a ruling?
There is a definitive ruling on that. Nothing said after the episode. The last episode was called Mirror Image. Because that episode has caused more discussion among fans than anything I've ever heard of. It really took the show, in my opinion, to a new level. And the editor of the book series, Ginger, said that she would be very uncomfortable trying to set something post-Mirror Image because the idea was Don Belisario's, and she thought that it was up to him to carry it on. And I think it also makes better commercial sense as well, because if you're dealing with the familiar confines of Quantum Leap, the average fan is going to want to see a book about a leap, not about a new level of leaping, so to speak, which is where I thought Mirror Image was going to bring us. Had the show continued.
Right. Now, since we're running out of time, we should discuss your next leap. What plans do you have to continue your writing career?
Well, I have another idea submitted to Berkeley Publishing. They have an open slot left in the book series, and I haven't heard anything from them yet, but I'm keeping a good thought, keeping my fingers crossed. As well, I'm working on getting an agent to sell my original stuff. That's a slow process. There's really nothing I can speak to definitively about it at this time. But, keeping hopeful.
Is your original stuff also science fiction?
I would call it sort of a far future religious fantasy. It's sort of about mankind having missed its salvation and having ordinary Joe Schlub, like in any fantasy, has to find something to save everybody. And in this case, it's a set of holy relics that will bring salvation back to mankind. He's got the help of an angel, and he is fighting the devil, so it brings you right there. I'm hoping that some people will be interested in it.
Well, it sounds like the stakes are pretty high in that one anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, and you mentioned you're doing a book signing. Now, that must be exciting, considering this is your first book. It's been out for, a week or something?
Yeah.
And you're
already
doing a signing?
Yeah.
That's great.
It's exciting and it's nerve-wracking at the same time, because I hope that people will come and, come down. If they want to talk about the book, I'd be more than happy to talk about it. Of course, sign it. I'm just hoping for a good showing. I hope that people can come and enjoy themselves. It's at Walden Books in Smith Haven Mall. That's in Lake Grove, and it's from 1 to 3 p.m.
Tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yes, tomorrow.
Right. So you, too, can meet Christopher DeFilippis. at Walden Books tomorrow in the Smith Haven Mall from 1 to 3 p.m. The book is Foreknowledge, the latest Quantum Leap novel, available from
Berkeley Publishing.
Berkeley Publishing. All right, well, thank you for coming down tonight, Christopher.
Thank you.
Nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you, too.
And thank you for letting us debut your book.
Anytime.
You're on the show.
You can debut my next one as well.
Oh, glad to.
Just fine with me.
Glad to.
I just appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Oh, and we're glad to have you here. All right, well, before we leap out of here, I'll remind you that ICON 17 will be held on the campus of the State University of New York at Stony Brook on March 27th, 28th, and 29th. Are you planning on attending ICON?
Definitely.
As a guest or as a...
You have my number. If they want me as a guest, they can call me. I mean, that's fine with me.
All right. The author guest of honor at ICON will be Norman Spinrad, and Frederick Pohl will be receiving the 1998 Galoon Award. Also, John L. Coker III will be the first recipient of the Sam Moskowitz Fan Award. Other authors and editors who will be attending include Alan Steele, J.N. Williamson, Carol M. Schwiller, Michael Swanwick, Brenda Clough, Ian Randall Strock, Linda Addison, Michael Kandel, Charles Gannon, John Norman, F. Gwynplaine McIntyre, Terry McGarry, Joshua Bilmes, Theodore Krulik, Barry Malzberg, James Morrow, Irwin Filthy Pierre Strauss, Kyle Stewart, Dan Gallagher, Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, Gerard Warner, former Destiny's guests Hal Clement and John Peel, and once and future guests Julie Schwartz and David Kyle. Guests from the comic book industry scheduled to attend include Rich Faber, Joe St. Pierre, John Green, Gary Cohn, Maria Beccari, Jorge Gonzalez, Maurice Mercy Van Black, Brian Yelverton, Brigitte Slierton, Mark Bernardo, Andy Ball, Bill Roseman, and Destiny's guest Bob Greenberger, Bob Rozakis, Ken Gale, and Glenn Greenberg. For more information about ICON 17, you can call 516-632-6045. That's 632-6045. Or check out the ICON website at www.iconsf.org. That's www.iconsf.org. And for more information about what's coming up on Destinies, including next week's full-length adventure of the Green Hornet on the Destinies Radio Theater, our March 13th interview with Jerry Doyle, recorded at ICON 14, our ICON 17 trilogy, our April 17th interview with Elliot S. Magan, or Destiny's 15th anniversary special on April 24th, you can write to Destinies, care of WUSB-FM, SUNY at Stony Brook, Stony Brook, New York, 11794, or you can call us at 516-632-6901. That's 632-6901, either right after the show or on Wednesdays after 8 p.m. You can also send email to destinies1@aol.com. That's destinies1@aol.com. And if you'd like to send email to Christopher DeFilippis, his address is dflip@aol.com. That's dflip@aol.com. Destinies is produced by members and friends of the Science Fiction Forum in association with WUSB Stony Brook. The forum meets on Wednesday nights at 8:30 in room 029 in Harriman Hall on the SUNY at Stony Brook campus, and holds movie nights on Thursdays at 8. Until next Friday at 11:30 p.m., we will travel back to the golden age of radio with an episode of The Green Hornet. This is Howard Margolin thanking Christopher DeFilippis for joining us tonight, reminding you to stay tuned for Don't Look Now with Kate coming up next on WUSB, and wishing you the best of all possible destinies.
This is Michael O'Hare of Babylon 5, and even at the dawn of the third age of mankind, Destinies, the voice of science fiction, can be heard every Friday at 11:30 p.m. on 90.1 FM WUSB, Stony Brook. It's our last best hope for science fiction radio.